Hey, what's up, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Bar Talk Sports Podcast here on all your podcasting services. I am your host, Gregory Hall, and this is the week of December 17th. I'm here to cover everything in the MLB, NFL, NBA, and NHL. Just a little quick rundown for today's show. We're going to talk a little bit about the White Sox acquisitions in the MLB. And their outlook for the 2015 season. There's a rumored trade that has maybe already happened by the time you're hearing this. And we're going to cover everything in the NFL with Mike Berry, BarTalkSports.net football writer. We're going to talk a little bit about Jabari Parker and the NBA and the NHL, the case of the mumps, that crazy shootout, and some more coaching decisions. With that being said, we're going to start the show off with the NFL and Bar Talk Sports writer Mike Berry. Before we get to that, though, just a quick way of how you can find us. You can go ahead and search us out on Facebook. It is Bar Talk Sports Podcast. Just search Bar Talk Sports Podcast in the search bar or Facebook.com/Bar Talk Sports Podcast. Obviously, you can find us all on BarTalkSports.net to find any of our episodes on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Podomatic, any podcast service you choose. You can find us there. We come out every single week. Remember also, for you Philadelphia fans out there, I've been plugging them since week one, go find those guys over at the War Room and take a look at those guys, listen to their show. They are fantastic, and I wouldn't be here without them. And with that, we bring in Bar Talk Sports writer Mike Berry. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Before we get into the NFL talk, Mike, here, you've been writing for BarTalkSports.net. Mike, where can people find you?
Yeah, my Twitter handle is at BerryM3. That's BerryM3.
All right, let's get right into the talk here, Mike. Everybody wants to talk about it. We'll just get right into it. Johnny Manziel made his NFL debut. Well, I'm sorry, his first NFL start this past weekend in a 30-0 drubbing against the Cincinnati Bengals. Go ahead, break down his performance for us, Mike.
Well, if you're looking just straight at the stats, obviously, and the game for that matter, it was not a great start. 30-0 loss to Cincinnati. That was at home. He went 10-for-18 for 80 yards and had 5 rushes for 13 yards. So something not really people were expecting to that manner. A lot of different thoughts here and there that people have been giving, you know, whether it be the fact that he, you know, after one game, he's not a quarterback in the NFL. Is it the offensive line fault? Is it the offensive coordinator's fault? There's a lot of different concepts going on, but just to toss some things out, you know, the one thing that a lot of people have been talking about is that third down and fourth down conversions, they went 1-for-10 on third down. Didn't really give a good opportunity, in my opinion, of him completing passes, unfortunately for Manziel. And it's been a thing for him his whole life. He's 5'11", so he wasn't rolled out necessarily as much as what people were anticipating. A lot of more drop back passes. And Cincinnati sacked him 3 times, and they definitely pressured him a little bit more than that. But we're talking about a Cincinnati Bengals team that I wrote up in that article last week that was dead last in sacks. So they were dead last in sacks and got a lot of pressure on him. They only blitzed him twice out of 24 times that he dropped back. So they were causing havoc on him without, sending guys. They spied him a lot. With linebackers and secondary players, which I would imagine that Cleveland was anticipating them blitzing a little bit more, and maybe that led to some issues. But, you know, obviously not necessarily the start that Cleveland wanted for Johnny Manziel. Like I talked about earlier, a lot of people kind of pointing the finger at the offensive line. They didn't do a great job, and, you know, their offensive coordinator there in Cleveland is Kyle Shanahan, and his last job was with the Redskins, and people are comparing what they did with Robert Griffin III with Manziel. So hopefully they can get that back on track. But like I said, Johnny Manziel's game isn't drop back passes. Johnny Manziel is more of a quarterback that you're going to see, like I said, needs to roll out. You need to have called play runs for him. They did run a couple times, some zone read or read option, depending upon how you feel about that. And that's not something that he did at Texas A&M. The play calls that were runs for Johnny Manziel at Texas A&M were more kind of like a quarterback counter, quarterback power. And I alluded to that with Cam Newton against Cincinnati in the article that I did last week. And there just wasn't play calls like that in for Johnny Manziel. So, you know, it's a work in progress, definitely, for Cleveland. But after 1 week, it's not necessarily the great start that they were hoping to have. He's got two more games to play this season. They're pretty much out of the playoff picture as it is right now in that loaded AFC North. But definitely things to work on for the Cleveland Browns and Johnny Manziel.
If you brought up a whole bunch of stuff in there, right, that I want to talk about, but we'll hit on this first and foremost. There have been a million quarterbacks that have had trouble in their first game that went on to success in the NFL. The one that comes to mind off the top of your head is Peyton Manning, and no, we're not saying Johnny Manziel is Peyton Manning. That is not a comparison that you will hear me make on this show. However, just to for these people that kind of just explode and say after one start, because he did play earlier in the season here and there, that he's a failure, that he's a bust, that he's this, that he's that, I don't see it because there's no way to judge him. This is something that you can't just take one game, extremely small sample size, and make such a rash decision, such a rash judgment on. The guy's going to need at least a full season, at least, to before he can develop, before you can make a judgment call on him. I don't think it's fair, all the critics. Obviously there was so much hype surrounding this guy, and a lot of it was himself, put it on himself, by himself. I did kind of laugh a little bit, and like, you know, when Malaluga did the money signs and things of that nature, just to, I guess you can call it playful banter. I guess you can call it, or you can call it like, get out of my face, kid. Earn your respect in this league. But we, like I said, we've had quarterbacks that have gone on to successful careers. If you had two, and I know this is kind of a tough call to make, but if you had to kind of project where or what type, or if you could project a quarterback that you see Johnny Manziel turning into that is currently in the NFL, would you say he's more of like a Russell Wilson? Could you say he has the potential of an Aaron Rodgers? Or do you think, given his small frame, he could be a pocket passer and turn into that a la Drew Brees, who was a very small quarterback who has turned himself into a damn fine pocket passer?
Yeah, well, and you just hit on some pretty good things there. When you talk about the height, you can only really – currently in the NFL, you really think of Drew Brees as that one guy that's kind of below the 6 foot level when it comes to just from the height. I would say that as of right now, the tool set and the offense he ran in college, you would say in comparison to RG3, Robert Griffin III, I would say that in order for them to be successful, he's going to have to become someone like Russell Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
Just to throw out some other names here, like you said, you know, obviously Peyton Manning would be the one that you would say that whole season. I was watching something on NFL.com where Marshall Faulk played with Manning, and just the speed of the game is so much incredibly more higher in the NFL as it is in college football, even for someone like Manziel or Manning who played in the SEC where they have some of the better defenses in college football. Four first-round quarterbacks that got shut out in their first career start. Johnny Manziel, one of them. Two of them are Hall of Famers, Troy Aikman and Bob Greasy, and then finally everybody's favorite XFL quarterback, Tommy Maddox. So, there you go, just drop XFL and Tommy Maddox in the same sentence. It's great stuff. But like I said, you know, I think it's going to have to be, like you mentioned, a Russell Wilson if they want to be successful. I think this Cleveland team obviously overachieved this year, even where they're at right now, even if they lose the next two games. At 7-9, they kind of seem like they overachieved. You would imagine it's going to probably be Manziel's ship going forward. So, you know, I imagine they're not going to sign Hoyer back in free agency. That's just a guess because I think his price tag's going to be a little bit too high, and the market's definitely out there for quarterbacks this upcoming year. But like Wilson, mixing some zone read stuff, he didn't do that at A&M. But and if you go back and look at some of the film that was there for the Bengals and Cleveland game, he definitely missed some reads where, you know, if you're at this read option, you check out maybe an outside linebacker. Most of the time you're checking out a defensive end. Defensive end's committing to the quarterback, and he should have handed the ball off here or there to some of Cleveland's talented running backs, young running backs. It's definitely a young team there in Cleveland. So I would imagine over time he's going to get more comfortable with that, a little bit more play action for him. But I definitely don't foresee him being a drop-back passer.
What you were saying earlier is I wanted to touch on this as well, and I'm glad you brought it up so I didn't forget about it. Cleveland 7-7 right now, Carolina and Baltimore to end the season. I believe they're both road games. I think you nailed it. This is a team that forever has kind of been stuck in mediocre to subpar since they came back in the league, and I think that you're finally seeing hope. This is an offense that can score. Have they scored lately? No, they've been shut down. Obviously, the reemergence, if you will, of Josh Gordon coming back into the league, being reinstated, I should say. And then like you touched on, Isaiah Crowell, Terrence West, the young running backs there. This offense shows a lot of promise. If Cleveland finishes 8-8, 7-9, I cannot say it was a failure of a season. Brian Hoyer did what he did. Yeah, I completely agree. He's going to go elsewhere in free agency. I believe he even alluded to it and said that he would like to go elsewhere. I mean, this was a circus in reality. Everybody there was just – they were just waiting for Manziel to take over. It wasn't a matter of if. It was a matter of when. And that pressure on a guy like Hoyer, I can't imagine it. So to touch on that, I don't necessarily consider this a failure of a season. I agree with you. He got to sit back for, 14 weeks, learn, and he came in. He did what he did. I guess you can't really do worse. I guess things can only be looking up for Johnny Manziel in Cleveland. What I kind of wanted to touch on for Johnny Manziel, like you said earlier, he's got – I mean, the ceiling for this kid is pretty much it's whatever it can be. He's got a very, very high ceiling. Do you – project Cleveland to be a contender with Johnny Manziel? And let me kind of elaborate. Do you feel like Cleveland is going to now tailor their offense to their quarterback, or do you feel like their quarterback is going to have to learn their offensive system?
I think that if they want to be successful, they're going to have to tailor it a little bit to him. Looking at Cleveland, I know it definitely depends on personnel moves they need to do. It definitely doesn't help the fact that they might be in one of the tougher divisions, divisions in the league, with Cincinnati and Baltimore and Pittsburgh. Those are three teams that are perennial playoff teams here in the last 3 years. So I think, it's kind of there. I think you want to see something a little bit more tailored towards the, I'm going to say, Chip Kelly style offense in Philadelphia right now, where they have that going on. They're going to have to do something different because ground and pound is wonderful. However, in that division where those teams, Cincinnati doesn't have a great defense. They played well last Sunday. But if you've got to beat Pittsburgh and Baltimore on a consistent basis, that's going to be tough. And they're going to have to try something new and give the options here. But you alluded to it earlier. It's going to take an offseason. These three games here are just kind of to get, used to the speed of the game and keep on building around them. Like you mentioned, some good running backs, good receiver in Josh Gordon, definitely some parts here and there. But he's going to have to definitely, they're going to have to adjust to him. I don't foresee him being your prototypical Peyton Manning, Tom Brady type passer in this league.
Mike, you're a coach for football. You're a football coach. Do you agree with that philosophy? Do you think that a team should have to tailor their offense around the quarterback? Or do you feel like you've come in, you've put this system in place, I'm going to get a guy who fits my system?
Well, there's certainly a lot of speculation that Cleveland and their GM, and the name slips my mind at the moment, but the GM got Johnny Manziel to sell tickets, to sell jerseys.
He did just that. He did do that.
And that's kind of like, like I said earlier, it kind of matches up with the RG3 thing going on in Washington right now. Kyle Shanahan was his offensive coordinator. So obviously they had things work out in his initial rookie season. However, when he got hurt, things got a little bit more protective. I don't know, obviously looking at one, I don't know if Cleveland's trying to protect Johnny Manziel and get him for the next year without any major injuries, and then try to get everything going. But those two pieces really don't fit. I think, in general, if you're talking high school football, then you're definitely always adjusting yourself to your personnel. However, this is the NFL, and they have the opportunity to go out and get pieces to what they want. You always talk about – everybody always talks about Bill Belichick and the Patriot way. Well, he doesn't care who it is. He's going to get the guys that he thinks he can get to – do what he wants at the right price. So I think they're going to have to make slight adjustments. I think that will happen over time. I don't know if we'll see him this year.
Mike, to wrap up the Johnny Manziel talk, do you think this kid, take week one or his first start out of the equation, do you think he has what it takes to be a successful quarterback in this league? And On top of that, not just successful, but a champion?
I would say that there's good reason for speculation on that. I think it's championship is definitely a long time down the road, but I definitely think that the guy's heart and spirit is into it. There's no questioning that. I think for this particular year, it didn't help that Brian Hoyer did such a great job at quarterback for them early on. So I think the championships, the AFC North, which, you know, they were up into a couple weeks ago into contention for, I think that's possible down the line. But again, there's a lot more pieces Cleveland needs. I think Manziel is one of them.
Mike, let's move on a little bit. Usually I do the next segments here where I do like NFL Game of the Week and I do my power rankings for the week, but I'm going to lead this off to you. Let's get into it. Week 16, 2 weeks left of the regular season, and hopefully we can have you back on previewing the playoff games here in a couple weeks. But Mike, your game of the week in the NFL for week 16.
Yeah, and you know what? There's a lot of good candidates. If we were talking next week, I'm telling you already next week, the game of the week is the Detroit Lions and Green Bay Packers. After the Packers lost this past week, you know, Detroit currently is number two seeded in the NFC, which is mind-blowing. But this week, you know, good candidates. Kansas City and Pittsburgh's a good game. Denver and Cincinnati, that's the Monday nighter. That's a good one. Indianapolis and Dallas. And it's kind of funny to say, but the Falcons at the Saints for that NFC South, that's pretty terrible right now. And then, you know, and again, depending upon how you feel about things, the NFL draft coming up, the Tennessee Titans-Jacksonville Jaguars game on Thursday night's a pretty big deal for that, for draft pick selections. But I'm going to go with Seattle at Arizona.
Mike, tell me a little bit about Seattle and Arizona. Why do you think it is the game of the week? Obviously, there are playoff implications on the line. Arizona has clinched a playoff spot, Seattle, but they're fighting for the division here. Tell us a little bit about the game.
Yeah, well, let's start off with Seattle won in Week 12. They won 19-3. The only touchdown was in the third quarter. That was about with 52 seconds left. That was a Russell Wilson 20-yard pass. A couple different notes from there. Arizona had 7 sacks on Russell Wilson. So, and people, you know, for as much difficulty Arizona has had with the injuries to their quarterbacks, the defense has done a stellar job this year. Russell Wilson was actually the game-leading rusher in that game with 73 yards. Marshawn Lynch only had 39. So the big thing going into this week's game is, you know, they're playing for the division still. There's a lot riding on it. Arizona, as I mentioned earlier, battling a lot of injuries at quarterback. You're going to get a start from Ryan Lindley. He's a San Diego State alum. The last time he started, I believe, was when he was a rookie, and that was in 2012. He didn't start that day, but he played against Seattle in that game, 8 for 17, 59 yards, and Seattle unfortunately won that game 58-0. So he's 1-3 as a career starter, never thrown a touchdown pass, and I love this stat right here. He's never thrown a touchdown pass in 181 career passes. That's the most attempts in NFL history without a touchdown.
I was really hoping you wouldn't bring up the score of that game. that was an embarrassing one, but that is a great stat. I think it tells a lot. Seattle, Mike, has come alive recently at the same time where even though Arizona's winning football games still, you can tell they're not the same team.
Yeah, and you know, for that same token, I think there's a couple things guaranteed in the NFL right now. There's not many, but there's a couple things. J.J. Watt's the defensive player of the year, and Bruce Arians is the runaway coach of the year because the job he's been doing there in Arizona with everything that's been going on is absolutely phenomenal. You know, they're gonna have this Lindley starting at quarterback. They could potentially play rookie Logan Thomas. He was a rookie out of Virginia Tech. He might be going in situations where, you know, kind of like we talked with Manziel, Robert Griffin, running certain read option plays for them to give them a changeup. Last time they played, 19-3, Seattle only scored one touchdown, so it's definitely going to be a defensive battle and whose kicker is going to have a better game, whose special teams might win the game for them.
Mike, who's going to win the game?
I'm going to go with Seattle. Like you just mentioned, you know, they're definitely playing a lot better. As of recently, less injuries. Marshawn Lynch has really caught on here in the last couple weeks. They're running the ball a little bit better, playing great defense as always. You know, it's interesting. I think Seattle definitely needs this one better, because if they lose, you know, we're talking about, and we're concerned here with wild card teams in the NFC potentially not getting in at 10-6. So I definitely think Seattle needs this a little bit more than Arizona. You know, and for that token, you know, if the NFC playoffs have to go through Seattle, then I would give Seattle the edge. And, you know, depending upon those locations, I would say Seattle and Green Bay right now, the top two teams in the NFC, if you're well. And I think if you have to play Seattle at Seattle, that's a tough one.
Yeah,
they have a win over Green Bay. They have a win over Philadelphia. And they need this one, because if Dallas wins out, Dallas beat Seattle. So, you know, we might be sitting here in 2 weeks talking about Dallas being the number one seed overall in the NFC and having home field advantage, which is crazy to think with everything that's going on there. So I'm going to say Seattle's going to win this one. It's going to be another defensive battle. But I think they're going to take advantage of that quarterback situation in Arizona.
Not only did Dallas win against Seattle, Dallas won at Seattle and is undefeated on the road this season. So that might give them some confidence if they were to meet down the line. I agree with you, though. This could go through Seattle. I think Seattle has this. This could bode very, very poorly for the Cardinals for another aspect. The past eight teams that have played the Seahawks have lost the following week. Whether it's a win or loss, they've lost the following week. So this could be Arizona limping into the playoffs, something that we've seen in the past you just cannot do in the NFL.
No, absolutely. And if they limp in to the point where they're the sixth seed, you know, we're talking about them going probably somewhere like Philadelphia or Dallas or Green Bay. If they get in as the fifth seed, if they win one and lose one here, and they have to go in as the fifth seed, you're taking on that NFC South champion, and you got your chance. You got a pretty solid chance to make it to the next round. So they definitely need at least one of these next two games. I don't think it's happening in Seattle.
Mike, let's go on to the power rankings for this week, the top five and the bottom five. I'm just going to let you go on this. Here we go. Your top five in the NFL.
My top five, number one, let me ask you this. You want me to go 5-1 or 1-5?
Start at the top.
Start at the top. Okay, well, I'm going to start with the New England Patriots at number one. They defeated the Miami Dolphins 41-13 this past week.
That's going to hurt you, doesn't it?
It does hurt me. Okay, I didn't know if you knew I was a Miami Dolphins fan or not, but I am. You know, they were up one at halftime, 14-13, and then scored 27-0 in the second half there. So definitely routed the Dolphins in the second half. 24 points, consecutive possessions there in the third quarter. You know, Tom Brady's great. Healthy Gronk is even better, 96 yards and a touchdown. The running game's starting to click there with Jonathan Gray and LeGarrette Blount. So the Patriots obviously marching into the playoffs now as the AFC East champions. Number two, I got those previously mentioned Seattle Seahawks. They defeated the Niners 17-0. They had six sacks of Colin Kaepernick, and, you know, I'm sure they really took a lot of pleasure out of knocking the 49ers out of the playoff contention. I think the upcoming season here, we're going to see the Niners hit the reset button a little bit. Interesting stat here, 179 yards rushing per game since the Percy Harvin trade. So imagine, you know, Marshawn Lynch getting back on track like we mentioned earlier. Definitely going to help the Seahawks in the playoffs. Number three, I got the Denver Broncos. They defeated the Chargers 22-10. It wasn't the most prettiest of games for the Broncos. They haven't been killing teams as much as recently, but they just got by here. Peyton played with a thigh injury and a flu-like symptoms. Connor Barth 5-for-5 on field goals for them. You know, the thing for the Denver Broncos right now is they got that lead. They need to make sure they lost at New England 43-21 earlier this year. Again, that's another team that it would be helpful for them to get home field advantage throughout. I'm sure they don't want to go to New England and play in the playoffs. Number four, the only team in my top five that actually lost last week was Green Bay Packers again. If we talked about this last week, they're my number one team, but they drop after they lost to Buffalo 21-13. That was at Buffalo, and I mentioned this stat in my predictions last week. Green Bay still hasn't won a game at Buffalo ever in the NFL, which is kind of surprising. And, you know, Aaron Rodgers had a down game. They play Tampa Bay, which I'm going to talk about here in a second. They play Tampa Bay this week, and I have a feeling the Bucs are going to be on the bad end of a whooping. Number five, I'm going to go with Arizona. Even though, like we talked about, the quarterback situation isn't necessarily the greatest. They played a tough Rams team. I've actually predicted the Rams to win, but they won 12-6. Arizona did. And again, they really need this game against Seattle. While they clinched the playoff spot, again, they can't lose two in a row, slip with number six, and then expect to beat, you know, Philadelphia, you know, Green Bay, or Dallas, or whoever ends up in that number three slot. So that's my top five.
From the bottom five. I'm sorry?
Go ahead, Alex.
I was going to say, go bottom five, start, and I should say end with the 32nd team.
Okay. So I guess we're going to start off with number 28 then. And I'm going to put I kind of wanted to put them lower just because of the whole situation going on. But I got 28, I got the Washington Redskins. They lost at the Giants 24-13. I think, you know, the Redskins are, and you look at some of these teams that are going to be in the bottom five, and we knew they were going to be not the greatest teams in the world, but they have certain positions where they have bright spots. And really, you look for a bright spot on the Washington Redskins, and it's really hard to find. There's question marks all over the place. At quarterback, what's going to happen? RG3, Kirk Cousins, Colt McCoy, Jay Gruden, you know, what's going on with that? I heard he just got the thumbs up for next year, but still, the first year, a little bit higher expectations and didn't necessarily get the job done. That was my number 2018. 29th team I got going on here is the Oakland Raiders. They lost at Kansas City 31-13. It was actually the team they beat the first time around. But again, looking for bright spots for Oakland. You know, they're going to go into this draft. They're going to have a quarterback that they think they have confidence in with Derek Carr. He's playing well enough to get another chance to start next year. And I think Derek Carr is going to be a pretty solid NFL quarterback. They got Khalil Mack out of the University of Buffalo. He's playing an excellent linebacker. He could potentially be the defensive rookie of the year. My number 30 team, I got the Jacksonville Jaguars. They lost a tough one at Baltimore 20-12. The Jacksonville Jaguars, kind of like the Raiders. I think they have to give Blake Bortles a little bit more protection. League high 62 sacks given up for the Jaguars, 11 more than the second worst team. So I would imagine that's a team that's going to be drafting either for more weapons for Blake over the offseason or, you know, definitely got to look into that offensive line. Number 31, I got the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. They lost at Carolina 19-17. I think they had a chance to win this one when Cam Newton got into his accident and they were using Derek Anderson as their quarterback. And like we mentioned before, they got an angry Green Bay team coming in. And I don't think it's going to continue to be a good thing for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. That's a team that is probably going to finish. I would imagine they're going to finish up with the first draft pick overall, second draft pick, and you're going to be hearing them in talks for quarterback over the offseason. My last number 32 team, and I believe you had them there last week, and they're staying there, is Tennessee Titans.
I was hoping you'd say that.
They lost at home versus Jets 16-11. And man, it was pretty ugly. They're going to go back to Charlie Whitehurst again on Thursday night at quarterback. He actually had a career-high 233 yards against Jacksonville in Week 6. But he's been inactive from Week 8 to Week 15. So, you know, he's going to get another shot here with all the injuries that they've had to Mettenberg, to Locker. And we'll see. Again, the kind of an interesting matchup there with Tennessee and Jacksonville, almost jockeying for draft pick status. So we'll see who wins that one. That's going to obviously change up who's on the bottom next week.
I think I might be wrong, or maybe I'm not. I think Tennessee was actually leading that game against the Jets 5-3 at one point. I believe they were.
A couple people hit like two run home runs, and then, you know. So, but that's a sign of terrible football right there.
Sure is. Mike, let's finish up this segment here. We're going to switch to the college game real quick just to give you a few minutes for this platform to talk about the Heisman. Marcus Mariota obviously won it in runaway fashion, quite frankly. If you'd like to, just give us a quick wrap-up or your thoughts on the Heisman itself or Mariota, whatever you want. This is your time. Just take a few minutes and talk about that.
Sure. Well, you know, obviously all three guys that got selected to go to New York and get checked out for the Heisman here were great football players. I think you're going to see all of them probably, I would imagine, drafted in the first round. The one question mark I would have would be Melvin Gordon, just because of the whole concept of the two-back system now in the NFL. I'm sure he's going to get selected by somebody in the first round. It might be later on, and somebody's going to to get themselves a really good football player. I think Amari Cooper is definitely going to be one of the first, if not the first, wide receiver off the board. I wouldn't be surprised to see him in somewhere like Oakland, like Jacksonville, who has those young quarterbacks established that they're going to roll with here for a little bit. So he definitely did a great job. And, you know, Mariota has been getting a lot of talk, and I'm actually working on an article right now about him. You know, he's a great football player. Showed a lot of emotion during the speech. It was very intriguing to see. First Polynesian player to get the award, and it seemed like he was really representing that really well. You know, and we're still going to get to see him play. He's got the game against Florida State coming up here in the college playoff. It's going to be very interesting to see. I really hope to see Oregon match up with Alabama. That's my dream championship matchup there, to see if he can handle a defense like Alabama. The Pac-12 is becoming more and more one of the better, if not close to the best leagues in college football, but their defenses haven't been up to the level of, say, somebody like the SECs and an Alabama versus Oregon matchup. But they have to beat Florida State, and that's a whole other story. You know, but the article that I'm going to be working on here that's going to be hopefully posted here in the next couple of days is just hopefully, and I hope so, because I do like Marcus Mariota as a person and as a player, is the concept of system quarterback. And already heard some chirpings about it from different people, experts on vision, whether or not he's going to be able to succeed at the NFL level. And we talked about in great length Johnny Manziel's struggle in his first game, and whether or not people are going to have to start adjusting their offenses to the players that are coming out. You know, there's plenty of people out there that think he's a system quarterback, that, you know, the speed is going to catch up to him in the NFL. I don't think that's the case. I think his quarterback ratings has gone up throughout his years. His touchdowns have gone out throughout the years in Oregon, and his interceptions have gone down. So I think we're talking about a player, and, you know, unlike Manziel, this is a guy that's 6'4", 6'5". So he is that prototypical NFL player size for a quarterback that you would really like to see thrown over top of linemen reading the coverages and whatnot. So it's going to be interesting to see moving forward. You know, like, he's not, unless somebody trades up for him, and I love the different hashtags that I've been seeing about, you know, obviously everybody's going to link Philadelphia to trading up and trying to get him so he's matched up with Chip Kelly again. I think that would be pretty cool to see myself. But, you know, I don't know, and I hope for him that he can buck that system of being a system quarterback, and we can move on from that. Even though it might take some adjusting by NFL offensive coordinators for him, I hope for his sake that he's not stuck behind an offensive line that, like Blake Bortles, has been stuck behind this year, and he gets clobbered in his first year. It's just not a good experience. So, you know, we're going to get to see him a little bit more. I hope to see him for two games. I think Oregon's going to beat Florida State, but until they lose, I don't know. But, you know, I think we're going to see Marcus Mariota. I hope he transfers to a good NFL prospect. I think he's going to. I think he's going to wow some people at the combine. He's obviously going to get dissected like many, many first-round picks before him. But, you know, a great Heisman Trophy pick. I definitely think it was the rightful one. I think it's been a year in the making, and you know, we're gonna definitely get to see him in the pros here shortly.
Mike, great stuff. Again, bartalksports.net, college and professional football writer, Mike Berry. Mike, remind everybody, where can they find you?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at BerryM3. That's BerryM3.
Everybody go check him out. Mike, thank you so much for coming on the show. We'll have you on again soon.
Thanks for having me, Greg.
And switching it over to the NBA, some sad news. Jabari Parker, the number 2 overall pick in this past year's draft, tears his ACL. Originally thought it was to be a sprain, a completely torn in his left knee. The 19-year-old is going to go under some surgery. He's going to have it taken care of. He should be back on the court next season. Obviously, you never want to hear about this kind of thing. Jabari Parker, again, 19 years old, taken number 2 overall out of Duke by the Bucks, who have been 13-12 this year. They have been an average team, which is honestly good enough to get you into the playoffs in the Eastern Conference in a weak NBA. He was averaging 12 points a game, 5 rebounds a game. He was playing almost a half hour a game. This guy has done everything asked of him and more in a rookie season. And obviously, listen, you never want to wish injury on anyone, whether it be your biggest rival, whether it be somebody who plays for your team. Jabari Parker was bringing hope to a Milwaukee Bucks team. To have him go down like this, you never want to see it. In a league that, like I've said before, is superstar driven, this is a league that needs these type of players in it. This is a team, honestly, in Milwaukee who needs a player like that to succeed. They were 13-12 with him. Imagine what they're going to be without him. So you never want to see that happen. Obviously, you had the number one overall pick this year, Andrew Wiggins, surrounded in all sorts of trade rumors before he was eventually dealt. You have the number three overall pick by the Sixers, Joel Embiid, who's battling a foot injury. He is yet to make his NBA debut, and now a completely torn ACL for the young Jabari Parker, only 19 years old. If you want to pull a positive out of it, you can say, listen, he's only 19. He has the rest of his career ahead of him. Get this out of the way. This is something that can be recovered from. He's been well above average in his short NBA career, very small sample size, but I see no reason why Jabari Parker can't come back and do great things in the NBA. That's just my opinion on the matter. There was really a light NBA news week, no coaching changes, no major trades, no shakeups. I was almost considering skipping the NBA talk entirely this episode, but then the Parker news came out, and it's something where you can't ignore it. So I definitely wanted to hit on Jabari Parker and obviously send my condolences out to him and wish him a speedy recovery. Switching from the NBA to Major League Baseball, there's really one team I really wanted to focus on this week, and that was the Chicago White Sox. They're making all sorts of moves. This is a team that is really not standing for mediocrity. You've seen what the Kansas City Royals did last year, a team that a lot of people thought would be better, be improved. They go all the way to the World Series and lose it in seven games. The White Sox, they think, you know, they have to think to themselves, the Tigers are not as good. They're getting worse. They technically are without an ace. I mean, yes, Justin Verlander is still a damn fine pitcher, but they may potentially lose Max Scherzer. Everybody else just a year older. You have a Royals team that they did so well last year. Can they repeat that? I bet you they're thinking they can't. The White Sox, that is, thinking they can't. So what do? They go out, and on top of Chris Sale, they added another ace in Jeff Samardzija. They go out and they get that big right-handed bat that they needed with Melky Cabrera to shore up an outfield that is quite frankly underwhelming before the Cabrera signing. Now you have Adam Eaton in center field, Garcia in right. This is a team that will hit now. They brought in Adam LaRoche earlier in the offseason as well. They bring in closer David Robertson to shore up what I think is going to be a weak bullpen. I think if you have a spot on this team that you're looking ahead to 2015 and say they need to make changes, they still need to improve, it's the bullpen. I wouldn't sit around and stand for really what Zach Duke, who they brought in, and David Robertson to be the really only big arms in that bullpen, the big recognizable arm, if you will. So I think they have to still make a little bit of a splash in the bullpen, but the rotation should be shored up. Jose Quintana, John Danks, they have a good rotation. They should hit. LaRoche is a DH. Maybe they bring in Abreu as a DH and put LaRoche at first. That outfield situation, like I said, is now showing some promise. A little weak at third. They traded Gordon Beckham, their second baseman. Second and third, the infield's a little bit of a concern, but third base is no longer a power position, and second base never was. The catching situation, you just hope for good defense. So is this a team I think can make a run? Sure, but I don't think it is a team that will. I still think they are not going to contend for a title in 2015. Detroit is still the class of that division. Kansas City, I had picked them to win the division last year. They won the wild card and got to the World Series, came within a game of winning it. I can't believe that that actually came true. I wasn't spitballing or throwing things at the wall, hoping they would stick. But I can't say that I was like super duper confident. I made the pick on the War Room, my original show. Hey, listen, me, go me. So with the outlook for the AL Central, I mean, the Twins have made a couple moves to get Irvin Santana. They bring him into the rotation. The Indians have made a couple minor moves. I believe they just signed Gavin Floyd. They traded for Brandon Moss of the Oakland Athletics. So a couple minor moves, some shakeups in the AL Central. This is a division that I still think is going to end. Detroit's going to win it. Kansas City's going to come in second. The White Sox in third. And that's what I think is going to happen. I don't really see too much of a a shakeup. I don't see too much of a, you know, a shift of power. Cleveland's going to finish fourth, and then Minnesota's going to finish fifth. Cleveland's got a good team. They probably could finish third just as easily as fourth. They'll kind of battle it out there with the White Sox for a third or fourth, but it's not going to be enough for a playoff spot. Not going to be enough for the second wild card. I don't see the White Sox making a huge splash, a huge run at it. This Samardzija thing may be very, very, very temporary as well. He obviously pitched for the Cubs for so long. It's great to be back in the Windy City. Great to be back with Chicago. I'm sure he's happy about that. Found a lot of success with the Cubs, especially recently. Got traded to Oakland. Oakland obviously didn't do what they were supposed to do, so they've been selling everything, trying to retool that club. Losing Samardzija, losing Lester, after signing Billy Butler, then trading Brandon Moss. This very up and down offseason for Billy Bean and company, but that's kind of come to be expected, if you will. Out of Oakland. So for the AL Central, like I said, Detroit still claims it. As long as Miguel Cabrera is there, it's going to be tough to bet against them. Miguel Cabrera, Victor Martinez, Ian Kinsler. So hopefully they can find some pitching somewhere. They got rid of Porcello. They don't have Scherzer. Obviously, they added Yoenis Cespedes, so it's another big bat to add to Detroit. So you have to have some pitching there. So Detroit still wins the division. Kansas City second. And the White Sox, after all their moves, Samardzija, Robertson, LaRoche, Melky Cabrera, I still think they finished third. The only other thing I really wanted to bring up this week for baseball was there was a rumored trade. It may have happened by the time you're listening to the show. Will Myers, the once Kansas City Royal, was traded in the James Shields deal over to Tampa Bay, was AL Rookie of the Year in his rookie season, had a very, very down year last year. A lot of that was due to a broken wrist. I believe he batted in the 220s, over 300 or 400 plate appearances, missed the majority of the season because of said wrist injury. I'm sure that hampered him in the batter's box. That's the reason why he only hit in the 220s and didn't hit for much power. He is rumored to be on the move to San Diego. The Padres, after they acquire Matt Kemp, they want to keep bringing in the offense. They want to bring in a young talent here in Will Myers. There are rumored to be three teams involved, four teams involved. At this time, Wednesday, December 17th at 6:24 p.m. Eastern Time, as I record this, the details have not come out. There are no definite trades. This thing might fall apart. By the time you're listening to this, it might be old news, or it might have never happened. So do I kind of overall think that this would be a good deal for the Padres? Of course I do. But for Tampa Bay, who lost Andrew Friedman, the president, to who they lost their manager in Joe Maddon, who they lost David Price to a trade last year. I mean, this is a team that they very much underachieved last season in 2014, and they were looking to rebound. And then you lose all these pieces, and it just starts to fall apart. And you see now why they are a small market team with a small market budget, who had their run for 5 years or so, obviously made it to the World Series in 2008, but that's it. This team is going to have short windows of success and longer periods of failure. This is going into one of those longer periods of failure. They don't have the money to sign big-name free agents. Why they would take a kid like Myers, who is still controllable for so many seasons, and deal him away to San Diego? Yeah, I'm sure the package is going to be multiple prospects, and there's going to be a top prospect or two in the deal. And yeah, there might be a third team involved who can bring a piece Tampa Bay's way. But why would you give up on Will Myers already after two seasons when you dealt him in your he was the centerpiece in the James Shields / Wade Davis trade to the Royals, and you've seen that how that has paid off for Kansas City. If Kansas City doesn't bring back James Shields, which I'm not expecting them to do, they still won that trade. Will Myers, on the other hand, still has an infinite ceiling, still has all the potential in the world, the Jabari Parker of the MLB. This is a high draft pick with a high ceiling. He's got a lot of great years of baseball left in him, over a decade in my opinion. And for Tampa Bay, who can control him cheap for the next, 5 years, I think it is, maybe the next five seasons, you're going to give up on him already and send him to San Diego. There better be a very fine package of prospects / MLB talent coming back to Tampa Bay in that deal. And kudos to the Padres for going out there and wanting to make that deal. Again, the details at the time of this recording have not come out, much like the Jimmy Rollins deal last week, which still, by the way, have not come out. And it's been a whole week since we recorded that show, a little under a week, about 26 days and 22 hours since we recorded that show, and details have still not come out. So by the time you're hearing this, there still might not be any specifics on that trade. But just to get that out there, another trade in the works in baseball after what has been a crazy winter meetings and just a very hectic offseason, all while my team, the Philadelphia Phillies, have sat back and made exactly one move. Very disappointing on that aspect. But if Will Myers goes to San Diego, I almost don't care what they give up. They got Matt Kemp, they got Will Myers. They're winning the offseason, in my opinion, not overall, but I mean just in terms of like success and a failure for the offseason. If you can bring in a guy like Will Myers, that's a success right there, almost no matter what you give up. He's a young, controllable talent who has the world in his hands, and even in a place like Petco, I think he can survive, can thrive even. His power will probably be down just a little bit, as it does for almost everybody who hits in that ballpark. But San Diego showing that they want to contend. They're okay with bringing in money. They're okay with bringing in veterans. And they're okay, obviously, with building around young talent. So to have Will Myers in San Diego, to me, is a plus. Tampa Bay, if you make that move, if you've made that move by the time you're listening to this, hashtag fail. Hashtag fail. Come on, Tampa Bay. I don't see the reasoning behind it, unless he was a terrible clubhouse presence and you needed to rid yourself of that cancer, but I can't see that being the case. Last topic I actually want to touch on tonight, I figured with Mike's interview it was going to be a longer show. I kind of want to keep it under an hour like we've been consistently, right around the 45-minute mark, just enough for your drive to work. And again, I do appreciate everybody who's been listening, who's been downloading. We've been ranked in the top 100 in professional sports podcasts after just two shows. I mean, that's, to me, unbelievable. So thank you, everyone. Keep commenting. Keep rating. Keep subscribing. Keep liking the Facebook page. Do everything you possibly can to help us out. That would be greatly appreciated. Again, you don't know how far that goes and how much that means to us that you guys would even like the show and that you would take time out of your day to listen to us talk. So thank you so much. We really do appreciate it. We'll end the show tonight with a little hockey talk. NHL, the mumps. The mumps is going around everywhere. Kind of started in Anaheim. Now it's going through Pittsburgh, which I can't say I hate as a Philadelphia Flyers fan. But obviously, no, you never want to wish something like this to anyone. Sidney Crosby out for a week or two with the mumps. If you saw the picture, his face was a balloon. May have hit Marc-Andre Fleury. He left practice on Wednesday morning early. Feeling ill, could possibly be the mumps there. We'll probably know more Thursday morning, so by the time you're hearing this, there should be more news out about that Marc-Andre Fleury situation, some more fluidity about this, but just kind of don't want to get into like the specific players who have been affected by this, but the fact that this can even happen is what I kind of want to touch on. The mumps is a serious thing, and how it can spread around. I get it that the flu can spread around, the common cold, the fever. Something like the mumps to go around the locker rooms of the NHL, that's unbelievable that you couldn't pinpoint this and stop it before it started. I don't know how it started. This is pure speculation, and I love the NHL. It is my favorite thing on this planet. It is my favorite sport. I love to watch the competitiveness. I love to watch the Flyers-Penguins games, and I don't want to see a game where Crosby's not involved or Fleury's not involved, because as great of a player as respectively each one of those are, and as much as I don't want to see them burn my team, the Philadelphia Flyers, I want to see competitive hockey. I want to see the ambassadors of the game, night in and night out, take the ice for their teams, put the fans in the stands and make money for the league. That's what Corey Perry does for the Anaheim Ducks. That's what guys like Crosby or Fleury do for the Penguins. And that's what needs to stay. This is a controllable thing. I hope it's a controllable thing. I can't say it's for sure. I've never had the mumps. I don't know anyone with the mumps. But to have an outbreak of such a caliber affecting multiple clubs, multiple locker rooms, you have guys out for weeks for an illness that they had really poor exposure to. I mean, this is something that you have to contain. I don't personally know any, you know, ramifications. I don't know any, I guess, preventable ways for it. So again, this is much just speculation. I'm not a doctor. But to have something like the mumps go around the NHL locker rooms is kind of a, not a disgrace, but a little bit of an embarrassment. You would think that you would have some sort of way to control that, and it's just sad to see. So hopefully anybody affected with the mumps does kind of get over that, get better soon. We want the game in its top form. We want the game in its top shape, and that's the way for it to happen, is to just get rid of something like the mumps, because that's It's crazy that even happened. What else is kind of crazy that even happened was that 20-round shootout between the Panthers and Capitals that was eventually decided by the Florida Panthers and Nick Bjugstad coming in on a beautiful move on Braden Holtby. 20 rounds, 40 shooters, 7 missed shots, 11 goals, 22 saves. Unbelievable. And the star of that was the Roberto Luongo. Even though Alex Ovechkin scored twice out of his 3 attempts, Roberto Luongo made save after save, kept Florida in it, obviously. Not saying Braden Holtby wasn't fantastic, because he obviously was. The shootout went 20 rounds, 20 shooters. If that was the Flyers, it would have been over in 3. If that was the Devils, it would have been over in 3. So for that to go on, it was great to watch as like a SportsCenter fan, as the casual fan, but as a hockey fan, I hate the shootout, and I think a lot of my friends can agree with that, and that's what I kind of wanted to go into. Yeah, Florida won the game 2-1. That's all well and good. It's old news by the time you're listening to this. The shootout in general is a joke. It's a skills competition, and you have NHL teams vying for really valuable 2 points going up against each other one-on-one, shooter goalie. No, it's not 4-on-4. No, it's not 3-on-3. No, it's not golden goal. It is a one-on-one skills competition. And that is how you decide games. Do you see the NBA doing foul shots? Do you see the NFL putting on the place kickers? Or the MLB doing a home run derby to determine regular season games? No, you don't. It's only in the NHL. And yes, at the time they brought in the shootout, they needed it. Viewership was at a low. They were trying to change the game. They were bringing in all these new rules and bringing in viewers. So I get that. But it's over with. The AHL is, I believe, experimenting with 3-on-3 overtime. I'm not 100% positive on it, but I think they're doing that this year, and I really hope that it's been a successful trial run, because it needs to come to the NHL. I know I'm not alone in this thinking. The shootout is atrocious to sit there, and I root for a team that is pitiful at the shootout, so I'm assuming that my feelings may be a little skewed, a little biased, and I may think a little differently if I was one of the more successful shootout teams. Take my personal, I guess, feelings, or take my team, my root, you know, my hometown bias out of it. The shootout is awful. It is not something that should be decided in an NHL regular season game. The playoffs don't do it. The playoffs do continuous overtime till someone scores that goal and earns that victory. Yeah, if the Olympics want to go ahead and do it, and you want to have TJ Oshie shoot on Sergei Bobrovsky 11 times in a row, that's all well and good. You can't do that in the NHL. You can't decide games by a skills competition. With that being said, last thing I want to touch on, besides, I guess, Winnipeg defenseman Jacob Trouba, he's out till February. Just like Jabari Parker, speedy recovery to that youngster. He did a lot for the United States team in the World Juniors, and he's made a little bit of a mark here with Winnipeg in the NHL. So speedy recovery to him, because Winnipeg's defensemen can't stay healthy. Touching on Paul McLean's firing from Ottawa last week, Dallas Eakins has finally been fired from the Edmonton Oilers. A lot of people were saying that it wasn't him, it wasn't him. Mac T, Craig McTavish, the general manager for Edmonton, just didn't have the personnel in place, didn't have solid goaltending in Scrivens and Foss, didn't have good defense, even though they brought in Andrew Ferentz. I agree with that to an extent, but at the end of the day, it's a scapegoat thing. And it finally came down where Edmonton said, all right, this is enough. They have 20 points as at the time of this recording. Carolina has 19, so they're not quite in last place in the NHL again, but they are in the Connor McDavid sweepstakes again. And I think people in Edmonton are just tired of it. You see people in the stands, the losing ends now. And the only way they're going to show that is through apathy. And Edmonton doesn't have anything else besides the Oilers. The CFL does not count on this podcast, at least as a topic of conversation. For Edmonton's sake, Dallas Eakins, I remember this when he was, I think he was what, either an assistant with Toronto, or he was the AHL coach for the Toronto Marlies. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that was it. Good coach, solid prospect. Was supposed to come up and make waves here in the NHL. Edmonton gave him a shot, gave him a nice run, a nice leash. Couldn't perform yet again. Edmonton has just been stuck in subpar in the basement for years. This has been a 2 or 3 year rebuild that has lasted 3 times its stay. So what do you do if you're Edmonton? I hate to say it, but this is it. You have to pull the trigger on Dan Bylsma. I don't know why he is still unemployed. It may be his decision. If you're Edmonton, I think the one thing you do is you bring in a Dan Bylsma. He'll shape it up. Look what he did in Pittsburgh. I get it that he had three superstars or potentially four superstars if you count Letang, Chris Letang, the defenseman. Even James Neal at one point was considered a star in the league, not necessarily a superstar status. So he had some great players, but he had to coach them. And he had a system in place that worked. Pittsburgh is a dominant team. Is a dominant team, will still be a dominant team for years. Can't wait to see them struggle again, but that's probably when I'm in my 30s or 40s until they're bad again. But Dan Bylsma still just sitting out there. That's the one move you kind of have to make before somebody else does. I mean, somebody's going to get on this. This is not the last coaching change of the year. This might not even be the last coaching change of 2014, much less the NHL regular season. So if you're Edmonton, you can shake up the roster. You can trade an Eberle. You can trade a David Perron. You can trade even a Taylor Hall. But that's not going to just bring you a Stanley Cup. You have to have a bench boss to do that. And I think Dan Bylsma is the guy for the job. That being said, that is this week's episode of the Bar Talk Sports Podcast here on iTunes, Stitcher, Podomatic, and all your podcast services. Again, we post weekly. Next week is Christmas, and the week after that is New Year's. There's 2 weeks left in the year 2014. It's been a big year, and we're excited to do more things in 2015. But we're going to have a show next week. It's not going to be Christmas Eve. Again, we post on Wednesday nights. That would be Christmas Eve. So I would assume next Tuesday and the Tuesday following that is when you'll have your shows, episodes 4 and 5, this being episode 3. Just to give you a heads up, there will be shows the next 2 weeks, even though the holidays are there. If you're driving somewhere, stay safe, but you can have something to listen to. The Bar Talk Sports Podcast. You can find us at facebook.com/Bar Talk Sports Podcast, or just type in Bar Talk Sports Podcast in the search bar on Facebook. Read all the great articles over at bartalksports.net. Follow us on Twitter at BT Sports Podcast. And most of all, rate, comment, subscribe on iTunes. Please let us know. Give us some feedback. Write us some questions. We'll read them on the air. Answer everyone that comes through the pipeline. I promise you that much. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. My name is Greg Hall. We will see you next week again on the Bar Talk Sports Podcast. Have a great week.